right, well, I can do it like this. I'm a massage today. I don't know what's going to happen. Okay. Hi, I'm Sharon Crane. I'm an alcoholic. Since there's a lot of Texans here, let me see if I can get it right. Because of a very loving God, the prayers of people who love me and those who didn't, I've been sober since August 20th of 1975, and I'm very grateful for that. Thank you. And I feel extremely, I guess it's that oxygen depletion high going on around here, but I feel really good. I feel, looking around, there's so many people that I feel so loved by. And Kim, thank you for reading that, because that page 25 brings me such peace. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm not the garden variety kind at all. I am a gulper, as my husband said one day. I think I sat down from the podium and I drank a whole pitcher of water, and he said, she's a gulper. And so I thought Texans might appreciate that for sure. But I definitely drank a lot. And when my head is out to get me once in a while, I like to read that because it calms me down. I come to a meeting, I hear chapter 5. I can exhale, so thank you. I've been kind of needing a meeting today, and so I'll probably get it after this is over. I want to thank Sherry and Diane very much for their love and their care and the honor, and I'm here with some people that I admire and love and have watched grow up with my husband, and it couldn't be better. Six women I sponsor in the room. All in various degrees of sanity or insanity, but we're sharing the mountains and the little bit of the fifth step. So it's kind of a good thing. And I don't know. I just it's a wee program, and I'm very, very, very excited to be here and to be done after tonight. And there's so many people that I was thinking about Jimmy Williams. I was thinking about Ed Dreiss. I was thinking about Albert Myers. I was thinking about so many people from Texas that have touched my life in an amazing way, and that many of the people that still continue to touch my life in a positive and gracious and dignified way are in this room, and I want to thank you very much. I definitely am a... I'm an Iowa girl still. I went to the art walk, and everybody I bought something from, I had to get their name and find out about them. And, you know, I've been from Los Angeles a long time, but I am definitely still an Iowa girl. But it was my first resentment, I've got to tell you, growing up. I thought, Iowa. My son was 15 by the time I stopped sending him home to my mother and father to, you know, take tennis lessons and swimming. And he looked at me and said, Mom, how'd you ever grow up here? And I didn't really want to tell him because I didn't want to give him any ammunition. But we had a lot of fun. And I always waited for the spaceship. And that's the first thing I remember from my family, that I was a little bit different, that nothing was ever enough for me. I have great siblings. I have parents. My dad would kiss my mother on the neck as she was doing the dishes. He would thank her after every meal for what a good cook she was and give her a kiss. And I grew up around a lot of love. And it was never enough for me. I have early memories of just not fitting in with that family, not being enough. My sister, my older sister, who's a Mensa, I found out in Spanish that means stupid or something. Really made me happy when I found that out. But she saved me from a fire when I was 9, and she got a nice letter from the president or something, and we all sat there in our den in front of the piano, and the pictures were taken with Nancy with all of her awards, and I'm sitting next to her. This is in the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm sitting next to her going, you know, it's like the hero child. And I have a younger sister who's Nurse Sally, and she wanted to live in Alaska when she was 4, and that's what she still does. So she knew her purpose in life. And my little brother carried the family name, and he's making us all, you know, putting us to shame, becoming the doctor in the family. So then there was me. And now I was a little bit not enough love, not enough time, not enough There was never enough, and I was a little bit more emotional than everyone else, but they allowed me to be that. It was okay. Sharon's just, you know, it's the way she is. But I grew up barefoot and riding horses and no worries, really, until I noticed everybody around me was forming. They were forming. And I wasn't forming yet. But I'll tell you, the night that I hung out with the Clark boys and we went out in there, they had a 57 Chevy. It was really pretty. And they let me hang out with them because they let me. And the Clark boys went out to the Swisher. There were seven hills. We used to try to catch air over the hills. And no seat belts. It was exciting. And they had Canadian Club and Schlitz beer. And the other cars pulled up, and we put it on a radio station in Little Rock, Arkansas. They all synchronized the radio stations, and the football player boys were there. And Jeanette Andrews was sitting next to me in the hood of that Chevy, and she was formed. And I'm looking at her thinking, why is she wearing a sweater tucked into her shorts? And then I realize why she's wearing a sweater tucked into her shorts. She was smart. And her legs were just curvy, and her socks were rolled on just right with those tennis shoes. And I'm looking down at my skinny little knock-kneed ankles and my calves that hadn't formed and the other part of me that hadn't formed. And I want to fit in here, and I'm not fitting in. I don't know what to do, but the Canadian Club, thank you, Canada, started coming by. There was nothing better than breaking a seal off a bottle when you were underage and you got a real bottle. And Schlitz beer was going by, and something started to happen. I don't know if the stars got a little brighter or the music got a little louder, but I looked down and I was forming. And it was. I looked at my little legs and they were getting curvy. My calves were curving up, and I elbowed Jeanette in that sweater, and I thought, move on over, I'm here. And alcohol empowered me in a way that I liked. And I don't remember the rest of the evening. They told me about it, and I was the talk of the group, and I guess I won the chug-a-lug contest. I danced with some of the football players. I drove a car. And I was a lot of fun, and I had a rotten, wicked hangover. I didn't know that's what they called it, but I felt rotten the next morning. But my second thought was, I can't wait to get some more of that Canadian Club. And we went off to church, and you know, I said my little prayers, hoping God would forgive me, and just threw in a few Hail Marys because I knew, you know, that's what was necessary. And then okay, I'm forgiven, and I couldn't wait to go out and do it again. Now I'm a nice girl. At 16 years old, I'm chosen to go to the White House as a young citizen of America. I was your future. Now, that's kind of scary. And the only reason I went in that contest was to beat my older sister, which I did, and she didn't speak to me for about a year on that one. But I was there. There were 100 students from all over the country, two from each state, and I was drunk going through the reception line with the birds, Lucy Bird, Linda Bird, Lady Bird. I had to worry about stepping on my little patent leather shoe because I was going to fall over as we were having tea. The women got to go have tea. The girls got to have tea. And I thought, I shouldn't have drank with those boys from Virginia. You know, I met those boys from Virginia in the 4-H Center, and they were trouble. And I was 16 years old, worried about my drinking, and I have found some writing since because I had to come back and give this whole, you know, slideshow to the Rotary Club because I had paid for my trip to do this, and I found my my book, and I was trouble. I was in trouble and worried about it, but I wasn't telling anybody. I know better. I actually know better than to tell somebody about, you know, my sinning. It's what I thought it was, but I couldn't wait to sin again. It did something for me, and we drank a lot, and I compensated by being in every sport there was that I could be in, by being in every activity there was. I was a head majorette with that big hat and that big baton leading the band behind me. Many times with that, my head felt as big as that hat on a Saturday morning in a marching band behind me with my whistle. I had to have the whistle. Yeah, it was, thank you, drinkers like me in this room. But, you know, as I graduated, I was very drunk at the baccalaureate, and I was pretty drunk at graduation. I had found a boyfriend that I just thought he was everything I wanted. And I had a scholarship to go to Boulder, Colorado, but I stayed and went to the University of Iowa because I didn't want to go far away from him. That was my first mistake, big, big mistake. I went off to college, and it was the 60s. It wasn't just say no, it was just say thanks. And we had a lot of fun with our partying, and it wasn't very long before that sorority was getting a little bit too boring. It wasn't very long before I was hanging out at the student union a little bit too much with the revolutionaries that, you know, sat around and made up stories or something. But they were fun, and they were partiers, and it wasn't long before I, you know, found my boyfriend and his tutor expressing thanks one night under a sorority lamp that I drove by and said, "I think that's my fiancé." And so I went and got drunk because I wanted to, I had to use alcohol to go confront him. It was him, he was unfaithful to me. My mother said, "Aren't you going to cry?" And I said, "Nope." And I shoved that feeling somewhere down that deep in my right toe. There were a lot of events in my drinking that I wasn't going to cry, I wasn't going to feel, I was going to drink at those feelings. Everything was too painful. It wasn't long before my mother and father began to wonder what I'm doing. It wasn't long before I was asked by the art department to please not come back. I was at Joe's place drinking with my fake ID. I would go across the footbridge. I was toke up on something going across the footbridge. I would become a little bit in a blackout, a brownout. I would come to laying on the canvas with paint on me, making up a story about that's how creative I was. And I would roll around on the canvas with paint on me. But, you know, the professor was on to me. He said, "Please don't come back." And I, alcohol asked for my art talent, and I gave it. Alcohol asked for my dignity, and I gave it. Alcohol asked for the love of my father and mother, and I gave it. Alcohol asked for the love of my God, or the relationship I had. I was a little girl that knew God loved me, and that was enough. Alcohol asked for that, and I gave it. The innocence was gone. As I drank and into my early 20s, as I did my geographics, as now you have the basis of who I was. And alcohol changed me. Alcohol took me to a lot of places, king alcohol, and I went along. And that was my companion, and I was happy with it. It allowed me to be brave. It allowed me to be courageous. It allowed me to not feel. It allowed me to be tough. And I thought I had to start being tough. My dad would try to talk to me about how I looked a little funny, or maybe I hadn't been eating, or the person I brought home in the middle of the winter had no shoes on and eyes were spinning. That was the night I woke them up after the bar closed to have a talk with them because they wanted to, you know, find out what was going on with me. So I brought home my new friend who, as my husband describes, sometimes was post-verbal. I like that saying. He was post-verbal at the kitchen table. My mom and dad are woken up from a deep sleep out in the country outside of Mount Vernon, Iowa. And what is so important? And my father is looking at me like, "You better not have eloped with that." I could just see it in his eyes. And my mother is like going, "What?" And it's like, "You want me to share with you? Well, I've changed my name. I am not Sharon Kay anymore. That is too apple pie and Iowa and just too corny. I am Cher. And it's not like Sonny and Cher. It is S-H-A-R-E because I share and share alike." And my father set his jaw because he didn't say anything and he got up from the table and went back to bed. And my mother just went, "Oh, Sharon," and she just got up and went to bed. I'm going, "What? You want to know about my life? You want me to have a talk with you?" You know, and it was always their fault. "And you want to know why I'm this way? Let me tell you why I'm this way." My dad would come close. I would let him come close. I would let him see my pain. He would know what I was doing. He would know what was going on. I had cut my wrists, and I would back him off with my pain and my anger, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. There were times that I just wanted to start over. Just let me start over. And I knew I couldn't. I knew that the innocence was gone. And when you know that, there's no starting over. My dad knew way too much. He would ask me, and I would tell him. he brought the priest down to try to talk to me after I cut my wrists, and Father and I got smashed on whiskey sours. We got just smashed. It was my father was aghast. It was the first time he was speechless, I think, in his whole life. And but there was no answer for me. I went to psychiatrists. I didn't talk. You know, my dad and mom are paying for it. Let them. But I was dying inside, and I didn't know it was alcoholism. And my geographics, you know, I didn't know why. I'm in New York City. I've got a job in an ad agency. Things are looking good. They don't really know I'm from Iowa. I can fake I'm from Wisconsin. You know, they've got cheese, right? It's dignified, you know, pigs and corn. And then I would catch up with me, and then there I was again. And then I would end up at the organic farm in northern Wisconsin, and there I am again. Or the first commune I was ever at was out in Huntington Beach, California. And they kicked me out for drinking their bong wine. They said, you just have to go. All right, a few of you have, I can tell. It's like, they asked me to go, and my geographics, I always, there I am, there I am. And I... it was a piece of truth that I looked for my whole life. Why do I show up so fast? You know, why am I here already? I had this persona going. I was trying to fake it with myself. And I was such a good manipulator. I mean, this even came into sobriety. I was manipulating myself. I didn't even realize what a good manipulator I was of the emotions that I couldn't feel, didn't have the courage to feel, didn't have the, I had no tools to feel. I couldn't feel, it hurt too much. Everything hurt too much. Even water started to hurt. I know if the last of my drinking, I couldn't even take a bath because water hurt. Everything hurt. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was a speaker named Norm Alpe that used to speak a lot when I was newly sober. He used to talk about seconds and inches. He said, man, we're here just because, just by seconds and inches, we're the lucky ones to be here. And I knew exactly what he meant. And then another night, sitting in Ohio Street, he told me a piece of truth. He said, do you want to know why the grass is greener, newcomer? I was like, yeah. I've been waiting for, you know, 16 four-way hits of orange sunshine, you know, about four bottles of Gallo that night. I found truth, but it melted before I could write it down. So, you know, that was my only real close contact with truth that night. But Norm said, he's going to give you truth tonight. He said, the reason the grass was greener is because the other guy took care of his lawn. Oh, wow. That was that. I got it. You know? And he said, and we know what you're made of, newcomer, fertilizer. And it's like, all right, it's a truth night. Norm says, I made a fertilizer. It's okay. And we're going to dig it under and make a great lawn. And he laughed, and everybody laughed, and they looked at all the newcomers in the room, and I felt good. And I felt good being made a fertilizer and knowing a piece of truth that night. Alcoholics Anonymous has, I don't know, something about the old-timers. They give you the truth, but they, you know, they give you hope right behind it. You know, because the truth hurts sometimes. But right behind it, well, I've always been fed hope. And that's what we do for each other here. You know, my dad and I couldn't talk anymore. I continued on my geographics. I gave up any sort of hope of having a musical or an art career. I gave up any sort of hope of having any sort of career other than around alcohol. Alcohol was ruling my life. I joined the carnival, and that was probably the beginning of my demise. It's a long story, but the crop in Wisconsin and, you know, all of that, and it ended up, I was with Matt Armstrong shows, and I called my mother from Arkansas. She thought I was living in Wisconsin on an 85-acre farm with a guy. Maybe it'll work out. Maybe she'll get married. Maybe this is it. Maybe tapping those maple trees and living that kind of life is good for her, painting those mailboxes and growing organic food and other organic things. But now I'm in Arkansas calling my mother, Mom, if you're new, I'm just going to digress a minute, and you think, or newer, you think being sober is all about you, that's what you're supposed to think because you're new and you're thinking about you. But being in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, in your first year, they say there's at least 10 people that are digesting their dinner because they know where you are tonight, that are maybe a lot, they can go out to a movie and not worry about the phone ringing, that they have to go bail you out of jail, or that there's 10 people that are right behind you that have been praying for you or hoping for you to be safe, and that you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's about those 10 people. And the longer you're sober, that ripple gets bigger. It gets bigger, and it combines with other ripples. And my mother, I can't imagine getting a call, the many calls she got from me, because I really was her little favorite. I was. My mom and I have always had a great bond. And I called her from Arkansas and told her I was a shooting gallery girl with Matt Armstrong shows and how exciting it was. And she just couldn't believe it. And it's like, what? I'm not hurting anyone but me. Just leave me alone. And it's always stand back and watch me die. I'm not hurting anyone but me. But you're going to watch because I'm your daughter. And they say that there's 10 people behind you if you're new. And I continued on with this crazy carnival, and I got crazier, and my nice dog even started to bite people because it was that kind of environment. And, is eat or be eaten. And I, me and my bottle of Jose Cuervo Gold and my cowboy boots and my filthy mouth got us in a lot of trouble is what happened. And we got kicked out of, I think it was Monroe, Louisiana, and we went to Opelousas, and some of these people know these places, and seedy motels with bugs this big, and God, I was living, it was great, and writing my book, and as I would tell my mother, it's another chapter in my book, and she would just cry. But somewhere down in Bogalusa, I must have made somebody really mad, and one morning the door got kicked open, and there was Franklinton Parish Finest with a shotgun in my belly up against the cheap motel wall, and they wouldn't even give me a sheet. And they found everything in that room they needed to make me a felon in that state for sales and possession. And I tried to tell them it's my personal use and I'm bartering, and they didn't care. And my new carny boyfriend, he's a flat store guy, so he was very exciting, big stealer. And he had a pet skunk, and so he went to jail. The skunk went to jail. I went to jail, and my dog went to jail. And then they told me they killed my dog, but they hadn't. But they told me things like that. They wouldn't read me my rights. For 2 days, I screamed for my rights. And they finally typed them up and handed them through the bars, told me to shut up. And I started to detox in jail. And I'm drinking a lot of tequila and wine. I'm vodka, Jack Daniels, I am drinking. And now there is nothing in my system. And I am in Bogalusa, Louisiana jail. Kind of coming to, realizing the carnival's not coming back for me. My new best friends from Houston, especially Tiny, just go to Houston and ask for Tiny and we'll find you. And, my new best friends weren't coming back. And I started to see things and hear things. And I found a piece of a Coke bottle and I cut myself because I put blood all over the bunk because they're coming. And they were coming, and they walked into that cell at night, and they took what they wanted, but they left the alcoholic, crazy person alone, but for the grace of God. And after being in there about a week, not bathing, they took me in cuffs, threw me in this room, took me in the car and threw me in this room, and there sat my father. And I will tell you, I hope I never, ever forget, ever, how I felt at that moment. If I think that my drinking has anything to do with just me, I better remember that day. I hope you have a day seared in your heart that you will always remember how you felt. Because there sat my dad, who had to get on a plane in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, connect in O'Hare, buy a plane ticket to go to New Orleans, rent a car, get a map, find Bogalusa, bring his checkbook, to try to get daughter number two out of this, the biggest jackpot probably the family had ever had. And if I ever think that my sobriety is about me, if I ever get so unhumble, I hope I remember that day, because I was 20 years sober when I got to ask my dad about that day. You know how sponsors are. They don't let you go home and rip off scabs, you know. It's like, well, wait on that one. So I'm 20 years sober now. I think maybe we can talk about that day. And I got the permission to do it if it worked out. And it worked out. My dad was sitting at a dock at the end of a lake and in Wisconsin. And I went out there and sat down next to him. And you know how smart we are. Dad, do you remember the day? Yeah, he said, he kind of chuckled. And I said, I don't really remember much about it, because I remember him sitting right here, and I am right here, and I'm a mess. But I know that's my dad, and I know what he had to get through to get there. And I know it must have been painful seeing his daughter in handcuffs. But my dad said, and I remember, we didn't look eyeball to eyeball. My father and I had sit down and had breakfast together at the same table for years. There was too much pain between me and dad. When I was kind of needing a break from being on the road, my mother said, you can stay here, but please stay out of your dad's way because you break his heart. And my dad and I could not ride in the same car. It had been years of pain between me and my father. But I remember not looking at him and him not looking at me and the lawyer sitting here. And I said, do you remember that day, Dad? And he laughed and he said, of course. I said, what did I say? Do you remember? And he said, yeah. Now the lawyer would ask you a question, you go, I'm not guilty. The bail bondsman would ask you a question, you go, it's not my fault. And those are my two retorts to everything. I am not guilty and it's not my fault. And that's all I said, and they took me, my dad and I didn't hug. I didn't say, how's mom? You know, how's Zippy the dog? I didn't ask anything. They took me back to jail. My dad went home. They didn't let me out. They kept his money. I found New Orleans when they finally let me out, the French Quarter. And if you're a drinker, that's heaven. And if you're a drinker with a soul like I felt I had, which was becoming extinguished, there was not much light left in my soul. I was going through the alcoholic motions of hoping that this third rock glass full of Jose Cuervo, nice and neat, double rock glass, no salt, no lime, was going to put out the fire tonight. Maybe this person here that I'm meeting, maybe they have something to offer me. Maybe if I move to Florida for a little bit. Maybe if I go back up to St. Louis and look for that skunk man whose parole officer found him. I did find him, actually, and I moved to St. Louis just to find him because he left me. And I, you know, nobody discussed this whole thing. And he just left. And so I was sitting in the bar one night with my drag queen friends, and they... We were discussing my case, and you know, they had a lot of experience, so I was very drunk. I think I was drinking Jack Daniels, and so we decided I should move, and so we went and packed up my clothes, and they kept half my clothes, my dresses they liked especially, and I packed everything up. I went to the nearest bar to say goodbye. I didn't lock the car. Somebody ripped me off. I'm not even out of the French Quarter yet. This is my life, right? I'm drinking, and I'm free. I am free. And I get in that car that I paid $50 for that you got to name, you know, Thunderbolt, because they last longer if you name them. And I drove up to St. Louis to find the skunk man to discuss why he left me. You know, somewhere when the sun's coming up and I'm feeling a little bad, I got to start drinking again to get there. And I got to St. Louis and I found this guy. And this is the insanity of my relationships with anybody. This was the only person in my life that I felt I had any sort of relationship with. And it was the guy that we had knife fights and black eyes on a regular basis. Because that was normal for me now. I didn't grow up with that. But that had gone. That innocence had gone. It was normal for me to have this kind of relationship. And this is what happens to people who drink tequila and have alcoholism and chase it. And chase it, and I chased it, and I found him one night, and he got off his Harley, took his helmet off, he crashed it through the window, pulled me through by my hair, spit in my face, and said, "If I ever see you again, I'll kill you." And the police car pulled up, so it got, you know, we got separated, and so I let go of the relationship. I said, "Okay, I think this is over." And you know how sponsors are, right? I had this sponsor for 5 years named Ginny, and Ginny was fabulous with pinpointing me. And she, you know, we talked about relationships, and this came out, and she said, "Sharon, do you remember that girl in our group who used to walk around with this thing in her hand all the time, and she was kind of crazy and stood in the corner, but she always came to meetings, and she had this thing in her hand, and she put it in her pocket and wouldn't let anybody see whatever it was in her hand?" I thought, "Yeah." She said, "Well, you remind me of her." It's like, I'm 5 years sober. I've been through my steps. I'm not really carrying anything around in my hand, but I'll listen. I'll see this through with her because she's, you know, my sponsor. I want to see where this is going. And she said, "Well, one day she let me look in her hand. She trusted me enough." And I looked in her hand, and she let me peek in there, this thing that she had been guarding for about a year, and it was a dried up old turd. "You remind me of her." It's like, the turd, okay. She said, "You know, that guy in your life with the skunk and you wouldn't let go is like this turd in your life. You wouldn't let go." And I had one of the brilliant moments of my life because I looked at her and I said, "I know, but that turd belonged to me." And that, it was very true. That's how I felt, that he belonged to me, but it was over now. So 1975, I'm a bartender. I'm fired from the downtowner. I'm fired from the nice hotels. I'm in their little computer system. They had computers back then that they talked to each other. I am fired for being drunk. I went to I don't know if it was the Mont Leon or somewhere else and applied, and I'm a good bartender. I can make a mint julep. I can do whatever you need. I'm a good bartender as long as I'm drinking a little. But I had been fired for being drunk on the job, and that was in their computer, and they wouldn't hire me, and it was like, screw you. I'm going to go work the Lamplighter and Funky Butts and all the local joints because I got my bottle, my Jose Cuervo, and my back. And nobody's going to mess with me. They want you to drink with the patrons, and I drank with the patrons. And I helped myself to a lot of drinking money. And I worked Doc Holliday's Boondocks and a lot of those local places, and I became unemployable, even from those places. They didn't want me back. I got 86 from the Bastille, which is very hard to do. We painted the windows black so not a bit of sunlight would get through. And I went in to pay my tab, and they said, "You're out." I said, "I have money," and they said, "You're out." And I said, "What happened?" And they said, "Look at the ceiling fan. It was broken." I said, "Yeah, well, you were dancing up there last night, and you broke the ceiling fan." And, you know, I had a little bald spot. It was a good night. My head was sore. But that was okay, Billy said, but you got spun around, and you broke the good stuff. You broke some Bacardi. You broke some of the good bottles, and the owner's mad at you, so you're 86th. Boy, that was a blow. And I came to California on my way to Hawaii and landed at Barney's Beanery and saw the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in a bar for the first time in my life. And the girl was so drunk, the bartender took away her keys, told a taxi so she could go to A&A. And I had my Jose Cuervo, as did that whole seats of bars, the bar stool, the people out the door. And we gave her a toast as she went, "Good for you, Chris. Go to A&A." As she was drunk going out the door to a taxi with the Big Book under her arm. That's all I had ever known about Alcoholics Anonymous until my moment of grace, my seconds and inches, the day that will forever, I hope, will never extinguish in my heart, which was August 20th in 1975. And I was living above a liquor store, drinking my cheap red wine from a good Samaritan that had come down to Palm Springs and had gotten me out of the hospital. I was in there for 2 weeks. I was a victim of violent crime. I had been thrown out of a car. I had my jaw broken in 3 places. I had pretty much been abused in seconds and inches. Because laying there that morning with my concussion on that sand, I had my moment. I had that great fact deep down inside of me. It spoke to me. And I don't know if I was just humbled and beaten enough by alcohol I got to hear it, but it said, get up, I want to live. And I hadn't cared to live in a long time. And I had a detective. This was a big case. Jacoby and Myers eventually sent me, I think, $750. That was one of the first, you know, victims of violent crime in the state of California. And I think I was sober a few months when I got that, and I went and made some financial amends of some of my drinking buddies that I owed $50 to. You know, they find you. They don't care where they are. But I woke up that morning sipping on my red wine through the wires on the mouth where the tooth had been kicked out, and there's no more dreaming. There's no more magic click. There's no more who cares what mom and dad think. There's no more I don't need God. There's no more toughness. What was left of me, I really believe, was an ember of life. And at seconds and inches at that moment, he said, I can't have you stay here anymore. You're going to have to leave. And I had nowhere else to go, and I was tired. That's the beauty of that day, was that was perfect for me. I may have had a plan the next day. I may have come up with something the next day. But on August 20th, 1975, I had no plan. And he said, you have to leave. And I picked up the phone and called my mom in Iowa. And my mom said, I can't help you, Sharon. Go to the Salvation Army. And if my mom would have sent $20, you'd have another speaker. I know it, because I would have waited for that $20. But mom said no for the first time in my life that I remember. And the phone number sitting in front of me was Chris. Not putting together, she's the girl with the big book in the bar. But it was looking at me. And I think if that phone number would have been turned upside down and pushed under a phone book, would I have found it and called her? Would I have come to AA? Would I have been so lucky? But it was looking at me, and I picked up the phone and I called her, and she knew what had happened to me. She knew my drinking. She knew where I belonged. She was an in-and-out member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was out at that time. And she knew she couldn't 12-step me being drunk that day. So she, I'm not knowing any of this till much later, had me call a woman named Suzanne, who was sober almost 5 years. Now, I don't call strangers and ask for help. But at that moment, I did. I was that surrendered that I called Suzanne. And Suzanne said, put your drink down and put your joint down. I know, how does she know? I got both going right here. And that's what they call reading your mail. And Suzanne knew where I was staying, even through my broken jaw. She could get Duck Pond Liquor Store out. All the alcoholics knew that liquor store. They sold after hours. It was a great liquor store. It's now since been torn down. It breaks my heart. Just still I drive by there, I used to be able to see me sitting on the steps. She knew exactly where to tell me to go sit, and I listened to her. I don't know why. But I went and sat on those steps, and a car pulled up at that moment that was yellow and bright and hurt my eyes to look at it. And I'm looking at the people getting out of that car, two beautiful, beautiful California girls with bright smiles and bright eyes and bright hair and shiny and pretty. And I'm thinking, I don't like you. I don't know who you are. I don't know where we're going. They're here to help me. I have no idea that I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous to start a brand new life. I have no idea. If I would have known that, I would have said, see ya, forget it. But all I know is I have nowhere to go. And this woman sent two people to get me, to take me somewhere. And they wouldn't shut up. They talked incessantly about themselves. I couldn't get out of the back of the Volkswagen. At every red light, the driver would turn around and tell me about herself. And I had this clipping in my pocket of this unemployed bartender from New Orleans and what had happened to her. And I'm thinking, okay, someone's going to ask me about me pretty soon. You know, and I'm going to pull out this newspaper clipping. And nobody ever did. It was like people walked by me at meetings for like a month and go, God, look at her. She looks surrendered. Maybe she'll make it, you know. Or people would bring people over and go, look at this one's really surrendered. Take a look at her. She can't even talk. For the first 3 months in AA, I couldn't talk. I had to learn to listen. It was remarkable, really. They used to say, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. And I didn't talk for 3 months. And I didn't really know where I was or what was happening. And we went to this church, and I thought, oh, God, now they're going to... I'm going to have to tell them I don't believe in God anymore. I'm going to have to tell them that I burned that up. I'm going to have to tell them I don't know about my potential. Please don't ask. I'm going to have to tell them I don't have any money. I'm going to have to tell them a lot of things, and they're going to ask me to leave. And I walked up to the door, and a man with a suit and tie on, who I assumed was somehow related to the church, was standing in front of a kitchen behind him, and he came at me so fast, I was sure he was going to pull me in that kitchen and say, okay, look, you don't look that great right now. I mean, my jaw had been wired shut, my face was swollen, my eyes had that blood in them for months. I couldn't touch my cheekbones for 6 months. I was a mess. I was sure he was going to put me in that kitchen and say, when you clean up, you can come out here and sit with us. But go in here. But what he did was he had that excitement of seeing a newcomer. And it was the secretary of the meeting, and he ran up to me and he said, welcome. Well, I don't think he's talking to me, but he is talking to me. And he pulls me in this room where I don't know I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous yet. I can't quite figure it out. I thought pretty soon they're going to know who I am and they're going to have to ask me to leave. But it seemed like somebody must have tipped them off because they all figured out it was my first time there, you know? They all came by and took a sniff, you know, the whiff test. And they welcomed me. I didn't understand where I was still. Some lady raised my hand. Her name is Beverly. I still see her from time to time. Beverly A. raised my hand for me at my first meeting. I hear this guy at the podium talking. I don't know what he's yakking about. And then I hear him say he always waited for the spaceship to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. Spaceship people. That's what I thought, spaceship people. And I felt at home. I had that identification. And then I don't remember when, if it was the break or I don't remember when, but a man named Maurice came up to me, and he was the literature chairman. He wanted to make sure I got a big book. And then he brought that book, and I went, oh, that's right, this is alcohol, because I remembered that book. And he's going on and on about payment terms. And, you know, he's looking a little funny because I also hadn't had a drink in a while. And things are growing like his fingers and his nose. And, you know, I'm kind of looking at him, and I finally gave him a quarter. And he shut up. You know, he went over to his little literature table, I guess, and wrote down my name and wrote down my little payment terms. And he wrote in pencil, he wrote my name, he got my name out of me, my first name. And he wrote the date, and he wrote where I was in pencil, and he gave me that book for a quarter. I still had that second edition book with Maurice's handwriting in it. And at my watch, when I turned 1 year sober, we have a watch because we watch you turn. We're not going to let you go, you know. They're going to the bathroom, watch them, you know. And it's like, we watch. I'm at my watch. Now, I can't tell you what I had for breakfast yesterday, but I can tell you what I wore at my watch. I can tell you who was there. It was a really special, clear moment in my life of gratitude because it hadn't had much to do with me. Not that you don't know that at one. You still think it has an awful lot to do with you. But Maurice came in right before midnight, and he shook my hand. He said, I knew you were going to make it. You were the only newcomer that year that paid me back for that big book one quarter at a time. Because I didn't want to owe you guys anything. I was keeping score. I had a list going that a man named Chuck Nesbitt would follow me around. I don't know, that man just liked to, I don't know, there was something about my desperateness that he liked to get close to, I think. Chuck was a dignified man that wore suits and ties right up to the end of his cancer. He was a great man. He showed us how to die with a lot of dignity. I've had a lot of people in my life like that. Yeah, my sponsor a year ago, my second sponsor, Jenny, beautiful woman, she was my sponsor who gave me so much in life, and she's up there at that big meeting in the sky, too, with Maurice and Chuck. I know they're playing cards. They got Clint up there. They got Vince up there, you know. Probably Chuck C's going, oh, my God, I tried with these people, but, you know. They're still playing poker and smoking cigarettes. I know they are. And I've had so many people in my life that have touched me in such a way that you just can't ever repay. And Vince was my softball coach. I remember sitting around. We were a couple years sober, and General Service had this picnic, and I'm active because they said, get active. So I'm in general service for 2 years. 2 years? Who gave me a 2-year commitment? Oh, my God, you know? I'll be cookie girl because it's power, you know? I'll be, because if you don't like someone, there's no Fig Newtons happening for a while. I remember I got mad at Clint, and he came and he'd say, where's the Fig Newtons? I said, I don't know, Clint, they were out, you know? And I'd make these big peace signs, and they'd just come eat the cookies. They didn't care, but general service, 2 years, and sitting around with Vince, all these guys had teams. I thought, well, what about the girls? Don't we have a softball team? What's happening? And so we started to form this softball team, and we were a ragtag team. I think Jim Shaw Plumbing gave us, like, these red hats that were, you know, they're hip-hop-looking hats. So we were these little girls with these big hats, and we went out there, and we played another team that was scary when they came on the field. And I think we won, and you know, Clancy didn't want to give us any cred until we won, and then, you know, we started getting a little cred, but, you know, and that now there's so many girls' softball teams at that picnic, and, you know, it was really fun to just be a part of something with some really terrific people, and Vince was our coach, and we were AA all the way. We'd have to come early and sit in batting order at breakfast, you know, we have sit in batting order, all suited up, and, that's how I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous, with a lot of fun, a lot of love. Yeah, I did steps. I mean, first time through with Janet, and second time through with Jenny, and got married, and my father came out and walked me down the aisle. I'm 2 years sober, and my father comes out to California. And at the Pacific Group meeting, which is where I landed, my dad's, they asked for alcoholics from out of town. My father, the non-alcoholic, stands up. This is the only meeting he ever attended in his whole life. And he announces to everybody that he's Frank Meyer and he's here from Mount Vernon, Iowa to give his daughter away. And it was a really special moment. Nobody booed him and said, oh, you're not an alcoholic, sit down, you know. Many of the people in that room knew my story with my father. And he walked me down the aisle, and at the end of my wedding day, he looked at me and he said, Sharon, look at your life, you've got it made. If you think about doing what you were doing before, think twice. And somebody snapped a picture. We were eye to eye. And so I got to go home a lot of years and to be a good daughter and show up, and we got to have conversations, and things got better with me and Dad. We could go to the hardware store and not argue. And things got better, and 8 years of sobriety, my son was born, and my dad got to come out, and I got to name my son after his father. And life got really good, and then it got really different. At 10 years, I kind of had the rug pulled on my life, and thank God I had a home group in place. Thank God I had a loving God in my life that has come back 7 years sober from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes taking my cake that night. I felt something shoot through me that I hadn't felt in years. And it was the love of God. It was life. It was something that was a gift. And I've been chasing that feeling ever since. I think I'm always going to be a seeker, but my feet are firmly planted in Alcoholics Anonymous. And 10 years, my husband liked the newcomer in the room, and I mean, he was even a punk rocker for a while, and I mean, he's sober punk rocker. I went out there and tried, you know, I'm a new mom, right, and I'm trying to be, they're in this mosh pit, and I'm thinking, I've been here, done that, you know, it's like going to the bathroom scary with these women with their things and their hair and their pics that are, you know, looking at you like, I'm going to cut you, and it's just, you know, it was scary, but I was trying to fit in with my husband who had stopped going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I ended up in Al-Anon. I ended up with Marjorie Bernard as my sponsor, and Marjorie helped me a lot. Marjorie helped me stay in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he married her, and it was a rough year, and my sponsor got smoked some pot, and she was a newcomer, and I lost a lot in my heart that year, and I sat in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, upset. My feet kicked out, my arms folded, and a woman named Pat Hodges walked by me one night. She looked at me with her newcomer. I knew that this newcomer, because I had hung out with her at the yard. It was Saturday night. We all had our fresh sunburns from the yard. Pat walked over my legs that were kicked out with my folded arms and looked at her newcomer that I wanted to help too and said, "Look at Sharon, she's got 10 years. Do you want what she's got?" And I had a little epiphany. I thought, "I'll show you, Pat." And thank God I heard her. And I ended up with Clancy as my sponsor. I ended up with somebody louder than my head, somebody who made me stay in the room, not throw hot coffee on him. I was on my way one night, and he stopped me, and he took the coffee out of my hands, and he squared me off, and he said, "Sharon, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace." And if he would have stopped there, I would have said, "I want revenge. I don't really care about dignity and grace at the moment." But he said, "So you can be an example to the newcomer." And I heard him. Another epiphany, I heard him. And I left him alone, and they had a baby, and my life went on. And I got a better job, and I had to support my son. And my son grew up here in Alcoholics Anonymous. My son grew up in the middle of you. He grew up with compassion and passion and your love and your care and sometimes your scolding. And but he grew up in the middle here, and he's a good kid. And he's got a lot of ethics because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank you for that, because he's terrific. Hasn't seemed to bite him. He seems okay. But that year was a rough year, and I had this baby, and I'm out there driving to meetings. They would say, "Call me, do you want to speak in Sacramento?" And I say, "Sure, where is it?" You know, it's like 5 hours out of L.A. And I would put these newcomers in my car, and they would say, "Can we stop and go to the bathroom?" And I go, "No." I was very intense that year, and we got through it. We got through it with enough dignity and grace, and we left them alone, and their child grew up with my child. He wanted to know his brother, and so they got to know each other, and I bit my tongue, and I kept my mouth shut, and when he left her for somebody else, she told me she knew she could walk through it with dignity and grace because she had watched me. So you don't, whoever, you know, it's not my job to judge, thank God. You know, Chuck used to say, "It rains on the just and the unjust." And I just go, "What is he talking about?" I didn't get it, but I got it then. I got it then. My job is on page 77, which hit me one night in the middle of the night, like they had just put it in there, which is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. And that doesn't say I get to judge. I just am supposed to fit myself. Keep my eyes open, see what needs to be done, and do it. And it's not just for everybody in AA, it's for the world. It's for my neighbor, it's for people I work with, it's for the people on the freeway, it's for my shoe man, it's for anybody I meet. I'm supposed to bring the bright light. I think, I love your, you know, the spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. But I think the only thing that you have to do, for me it's simple, to lead a spiritual life is to brighten the corner where you live. And if I can just brighten the corner where I live every day a little bit, my day goes pretty good. My sunlight can shine on somebody who needs it. I can see a smile coming back at me. I can hear a voice that needs a little help. It's a lot of work to fit myself, but I do that. And my dad, when I was 5 years, 6, 7 years sober, I got this pretty good job, and Jenny was sponsoring me, and I was still married to husband number one, and I called her one night to tell her he was being mean to me, and it's like she had a checklist by the phone. She said, "I think it's time you made financial amends to your father." It's like, well, are we going to discuss him being mean to me here or something? And she said, "Call your dad up and ask him if you're paying back the money you owe him." Well, I didn't know she knew about all that money I owed him. You know, they're just, they go to sponsor school or something. They figure it out. I don't know, but. So I thought, okay, I'll appease her. I'll call my dad. I called my dad. Well, he had been to the wedding, bought the big book, read it, ran a calculator tape. My dad's a businessman. Looked at my dossier, which my brother said was quite large. Figured it all out, circled it red, and put it on, I think it's page 78, where it says most alcoholics owe money. Told my mother if he wasn't home and I got to that part of the book and I called, there it is. Now I have a new resentment. You know, I have this new resentment. He was too quick, it was too high. I call my sponsor. She laughs. You know, just no compassion. She just laughs. And she said, call him back in 2 days and see if you can, you know, work out a payment plan and, you know, see what you can do and make sure you follow that payment plan. So I call him back in 2 days and thinking he'll sleep on it and he'll amend it. Well, you know, I didn't get to go to Europe like the rest of the children, Dad. Don't you remember that? Thinking, you know, he'll get this in the middle of the night. Oh, that's right. I didn't buy her a car when she graduated from college. Oh, that's right. She took a few and she didn't graduate from college. Oh, well, no. We won't amend that then. So my dad accepted my payment terms, and I called Ginny, and she said, great, then without fail, I want you not to be late with that check that you send him on time at the beginning of every month. Do not be late, because you might be the only example your dad sees of Alcoholics Anonymous. Boy, when they lay that example of stuff on you, it's just like, here's Bill, here's Bob showing up, you know, they're watching, we heard that. And so I started to send my dad that check. But see, I have a sponsor who loved me more than I love myself. Wanted more for me than I thought I could have. Had been down the road with her experience. Takes the time to come sit on the rock with me and say, guess what? You can have more with your dad if you listen to me here. And what she said, do you want to grow through this with your dad? She didn't say, do you want to heal? Do you want to have a great relationship? She said, do you want to grow through this with your dad? And I thought, okay, I can grow through this. And I'm in a corner and I can't get out, so what do you want? And she said, put a note with that check. Tell him about your life. He didn't want to know about my life, but she said, do it anyway. So my dad got the check and the note, and she didn't forget. At the meeting, she'd say, did you get the, you'd send it on time? Did you send the note? Yeah. What'd you say? That we went on a prison panel. Oh, good. Okay, good. It's a start. Tell him about your life. And my dad got to know about my life through the check and the note in Alcoholics Anonymous. And because I had a sponsor louder than my head, because I had made a promise to her that I was trying to keep one check at a time, my dad got that example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for 4 years and about 9 months, as best I can figure, my dad got the check and the note. And our visits got easier, things got better. Looking back on it, I can see when I started to buy the Father's Day cards without sweating over them. I can see when it was easy to buy him a birthday present. Things started to shift. And he called me up between Christmas and New Year's. He dialed the phone himself. He said, Merry Christmas, Sharon. I don't want your money anymore. You're done, released, but don't stop sending me your notes. And I got to go. I got to grow through this with my dad and have a healing I didn't think was possible because of a sponsor that knew I could, that had the experience and the wisdom and the hope that I needed. And my dad and I got to have a lot of good years. And 10 years ago, he went out on a beautiful day in April on his little John Deere, and he had had a construction business, and he was retired and just out there trying to clear out some old equipment that was rusted out in the land, and he hit some loose dirt, and the tractor went over on him, and he was gone in a second. And it's been 10 years. And kissed my mother goodbye. I told her she was a great cook at lunch, walked out the door, and never came back. And when I got off the plane in Iowa the next day, Alcoholics Anonymous was already there with my mom, making coffee, getting the flowers, helping people out, making the food, doing the dishes. My mother sleeps at night because of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is not about me. Just for that alone, it is not about me. And my dad, at my mom and dad's 50th anniversary, my dad got to meet Casey. And when they called the siblings out, my father and mother were there with my dad's check. So there was Leo Greco accordion band. You know, I played accordion growing up. I know. Wasn't cool then. Still not cool. But I was the only one out of the four children that played the accordion. So, you know, I got that. And so they're playing, you know, some sort of accordion, a beer barrel polka, very softly, you know, and they're calling the children out. And, you know, the Mensa came out with her husband, the successful people. And Nurse Sally came out with her Alaska husband, the fisherman. And And when Casey and I walked out with my son, my dad lit up. If you just told me that's what I get, I'm happy with that. I am happy with that. Because my dad got to know the man in my life that I love. My dad got to see Alcoholics Anonymous at work. My dad got to see his daughter heal. When I went through that messy divorce, I thought, I had no idea that those amends I'd made, those financial amends that I had made, were for them, but it was for my mom and dad to be my mom and dad when their daughter was in trouble. The slate was clean, and my dad got to say to my mom, she needs a car, let's drive it out. Because the slate was clean, and he got to be my father. And I'm really, really grateful that I get that. Beth is in the room who I sponsored for 30 years. She kicked me away at her first meeting. She was drunk. I was trying to tie her shoes. And then she asked me to sponsor her a few months later. It was like, oh, no, but... She was on the ball team. She was shortstop. I was first base. We were a good team. We were a really good team. I've gotten the privilege to watch people grow up spiritually in Alcoholics Anonymous, Sherry. Diane. Nancy and Mary Jo and Teresa are here. Teresa used to be a nun. She's not anymore. I didn't have much to do with that. I really didn't. We painted her nails and pierced her ears one day. It was very exciting. And Mary Jo used to be sponsored by Sister Sheila, who I still sponsor. This beautiful nun who I get to tell her every week, don't worry, Sheila, have faith before we hang up. She's sober 20-something years in Alcoholics Anonymous and part of the Force for Good. And I am just surrounded by people. Nancy had the most powerful fifth step that I've ever seen happen. Transformation before my eyes. Aren't I lucky? I am such one of the lucky ones here at Alcoholics Anonymous that I get to sit with the transformation, that I get to be a proud mother, that I get to be an amazing, amazing child of God, that there's so much more to learn, there's so much more to do, there's so much more to be able to give back. I get to be with my soulmate. I get to be with a man that is going through some tough stuff right now. Tough stuff. But he is courageous, and he is funny, and he shows up. He shows up. And that's what we learned at Alcoholics Anonymous. There is hope if you show up. And have a sponsor, have someone louder than your head. I want to tell one more story, but I want to thank Brandy for being my hostess, too. It's very funny. Somebody calls your name Brandy, you know you're okay, right? And then, you know, she's kind of this sweet voice, and then I was talking to her Sunday. She called me on the phone, and she said, we're going to go to a topless restaurant tonight. And I went, okay, they really do it different around here. But she was talking tapas, but all I heard was, like, topless. And I think I got off the phone, and I looked at the girls at the table. I said, I think I'm going to a topless restaurant tonight. We laughed. We knew something was awry here. But my dad, 12-step the town drunk, and I didn't know this. My mother told me about this. And I used to love this town drunk. He would come borrow a bottle from my dad because my dad had a business, and it was a state-controlled liquor store. You couldn't go buy a bottle at a liquor store. You had to go to the state-controlled and sign for it. And my dad had a business. So we had a lot of alcohol, which I watered down and took Everclear brand. Oh, it's good stuff. But he would come and borrow a bottle, and if my parents weren't home, I would tell my dad that he borrowed two bottles, and I would get a bottle, and I loved this drunk. Please come to the house. It was great. Well, he came to my dad to complain about his wife and the marriage, and my dad said, you're an alcoholic. You should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Help my daughter. Maybe it'll help you. Here's the book. Didn't know that, and my mother told me that story after my dad was gone. And I was talking up in Thousand Oaks or somewhere in North of California, one of those nights where you don't want to have a carpool and you're tired and it's raining and you can't get there because it takes forever and you show up right at the break when they're calling your name. And it's Thursday night and you just want to go home and, you know, come on Friday, like a lot of days I had when I was new, is come on midnight. I was having one of those come on Friday days, and I showed up and I talked, and I mentioned that town drunk. Don't know why. And afterwards, this girl came up and said, I need to talk to you. And she looked all like, well, I thought, well, I touched her life or something, you know. No, no. She was a little bit in shock because that town drunk that my dad had 12-stepped is her uncle. And she told me, she said, you know, was that John? And I said, yeah. She said, well, he's my uncle and he's still sober. So it was a couple years after my dad was gone. And then she looked at me and she said, you know, my uncle that your dad gave the book to at 12-step, he 12-stepped me 2 years ago when I went home for a family reunion, and I have 2 years. And I felt the ripple hit the shore just for a moment. I got to see it. I got to feel it. I felt the spark of life and the spark of love in what we do here. I can't do this alone. I'm a link of the chain. I need you. Hook on up. My job is to keep my link shiny and to help if I can help. I have my days. I have my moments. It's been a pretty rough year, but we're getting through it. We're getting through it. I have my morning with my rescue animals. They all come and they get fed after we sit for a while. They don't know that they're my accountability for my morning meditation, but they are. And we have it in the morning, and then they're looking at me like, we're hungry, come on. And so then they get fed, and that's my morning, and that's how I start. And I am overpaid in Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel much of the time like a babe in the woods. And I've got to tell you, the innocence has come back. Deep and strong and bright. And I never thought that would happen. I used to think freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And I lived by that. That was my flag. And I've come to find out that freedom is a surrender that is God-given. Freedom is a day by seconds and inches that I was done and I got to come to you. Freedom is having a sponsor louder than my head so those days I can stay. Freedom is being able to give back. Freedom is being able to be, sit in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous shoulder to shoulder with people that are here like I am. We celebrate. We never forget that we got saved from the Titanic. We're still celebrating every time we get together. This is an amazing week. Mountains, fresh air, love, sunsets, sunrise. People I love, people I care about. Freedom is knowing that I am one of God's kids. I want to thank you very much for having me.